Now we wait at Radio Rewind. Now we wait at Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, fermented foods, very nutritious, very magic.
So you just shred up your cabbage, basically. You add a certain amount of salt by weight, and you kind of scrunch it together. You let it sit together, and what the salt does is it draws the liquid out of the cabbage. That becomes the environment in which these lactobacilli, which exist on the surface of the cabbage already, can start to grow and proliferate.
Taking stock of biological diversity using DNA barcodes.
It's ridiculous when you think about it that you take a liter of water. How much life can there be in such a small volume of water? And it's literally hundreds or even thousands of different species that we find.
And a frightening vision of a warming planet, hothouse Earth.
We propose that there could be what we call a planetary threshold, which is once those dominoes start falling, you can't stop it. And that would equate to a threshold that would eventually take the Earth system onto that hothouse trajectory that we postulate in this paper.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Bacteria are Earth's most ancient creatures, and there are lots of them, with a total mass 1,000 times more than all humans combined. Those microbes make planet Earth go round. Some of them are dangerous pathogens, most of them aren't. Indeed, some bacteria are great kitchen companions. Anna Sigrether has been playing around with bacteria for years, fermenting food and drinks. How did you get interested in fermentation?
Oh, boy.
And I know you've been into it for years.
Yeah, for years. I mean, I think that originally, you know, like many, many people who are kind of practicing fermentation in what I would call kind of this era of the fermentation revival of the last 15, 20 years or so, I came across the book Wild Fermentation by Sandor Katz, who is known by many to be kind of the godfather of the fermentation revival movement. And this book was kind of a cult hit. You know, it was quite published by a small publisher, and it was introducing this idea that you could do ferments at home just using kind of like the microbes that were present on surfaces. And you didn't have to buy a fancy culture. You didn't have to have any special lab equipment. And you could just kind of start engaging with the world of microbes that are already always present around you, and make these tasty and interesting and cultural foods in both meanings of the term culture.
So you started experimenting.
Yeah, I did. I did. And so this was probably, well, I don't know exactly the year that Wild Fermentation came out, but I probably came across it at least 10 years ago. And I was already a young kind of cook, self-taught cook, and very interested in food, and was already kind of running my own little catering business. So I just got curious about fermentation and started kind of incorporating it into my dishes.
Now, of course, bacteria engage in fermentation, but yeasts do as well. And you know, the yeasts, alcoholic fermentation, and the bacteria as well. I mean, the bacteria produce acids, and there are lots of different bacteria. Do you distinguish in your fermentation work between ferments that involve yeasts and those that involve bacteria?
I mean, obviously, like when you're making ferments, depending on which microbe you're working with or sets of microbes you're working with, you're going to have different processes. But I think that, you know, it's an interesting question, like to distinguish kind of between the maybe like more scientific biological definition of fermentation versus the kind of more culturally situated sets of practices that we call fermentation, which are not necessarily all the biological definition. For instance, you know, I work a lot with molds, and molds are not anaerobic, and so that's not the biological definition of fermentation. But culturally, they're still producing a microbially transformed food item, which I think within the sort of broader way of understanding fermentation today, we would call fermented. So to answer your question, I think like if I'm working with if I'm trying to make like a natural fermented beverage, like a natural wine or something out of a juice, I'll probably work with it in a similar way that I would work with something to create like a pickle. And those are two different microbes. The wine would be a yeast and the pickle would be a bacteria, but they both require an anaerobic environment. So a lot of the same principles apply. Whereas if I'm trying to make something like inoculated grain using the koji spores, then I would be treating that very differently because it's in an open air environment. You need to keep it warm. There's just a bunch of other kind of like hands-on practical environmental details.
But if I were to ask you what specific groups of bacteria are engaged in the fermentations or mediate the fermentations that you do, do you know which species or groups of bacteria these are?
I have some sense of an idea. I'm not a microbiologist, and I don't have access to like the equipment and tools to necessarily be like sampling my microbes and my ferments. But I generally know, you know, like if you're making anything that's like souring pickles or yogurt or things like that, you're using lactobacillus cultures. There's also other sets of bacteria that, you know, are at play in the primary colonization of things like sauerkraut. There's a bacteria called Leuconostoc that's, you know, produces some of the savoriness that that's a hallmark of good sauerkraut, at least to my understanding. And so as you gain a little bit more of that kind of technical awareness from your own hands-on practice, and you start to learn and sort of synthesize with some more kind of theoretical knowledge about these bacteria, and you can kind of start to like improve your fermentation practices by knowing, for instance, Leuconostoc prefers a cooler environment at the beginning of the ferment to take hold. So you want to keep your sauerkraut in a cooler place when it's first starting to ferment so that those bacteria can come in and generate some of the more like tasty flavors before the just lactobacillus just comes in and just, you know, rips that pH right down.
And you experiment. How do you figure out how to do a ferment? Like, you've been doing these for years. How do you go about doing a ferment? I mean, there are lots of different kinds of ferments. Where do you learn how to do this, and where do you get your bacterial cultures from?
Yeah, well,
maybe you want to talk specifically about a particular ferment that involves like sauerkraut, for example, and how you go about doing it, or any other ferment that interests you that involves bacteria.
Okay, so like so bacteria specifically?
Mm-hmm.
Sure, so I mean, sauerkraut's a great example because cabbage is a food that has bacteria already present on it. A lot of times, like if you look at a purple cabbage specifically, you've probably seen that kind of like white film that you can rub off with your finger on the surface of the cabbage leaves. And that's known to be kind of like a biofilm, basically, is what it's called. It's a assemblage of different kinds of microbes. And almost without a doubt, that contains some lactobacillus, which is the microbe that does the sort of main fermentation in sauerkraut. So it's already present on the food when you buy it. You know, it's good to be able to buy something that maybe isn't too sprayed with chemicals so that you don't have to wash it before you use it. So that's just a tip that I have for making ferments, especially like with cabbage. And what you do, all you need to do to create the environment for fermentation to take place, and by that I mean for to sort of provide the controlled environment for the controlled decomposition, which really is what fermentation is you need to add a certain percentage of salt. So you cut up the cabbage to increase the surface area. Increasing the surface area obviously just creates more entry points for the bacteria to get into the substance. It also creates more exit points for the water to flow out of the cabbage as it's drawn out by the, you know, the function of the salt. So you just shred up your cabbage, basically. You add a certain amount of salt by weight. Usually I do about 2.5% salt by weight. And you just let it, you kind of scrunch it together. You let it sit together. And what the salt does is it, as I said, it draws the liquid out of the cabbage. And it, in that, you know, cabbage, salty cabbage juice, that becomes the environment in which these lactobacilli, which exist on the surface of the cabbage already, can start to grow and proliferate. Now, the question is always like, is this, how do you know this is safe? Are there other bacteria? Well, the thing about salt is that it kind of inhibits the growth of a lot, almost all other bacterial strains, especially the ones that are going to be pathogenic or hurt you.
Like botulism.
Yes, exactly, botulism. So you're pretty much guaranteed, especially in the case of like, once you're getting into those percentages of salt by weight, there's, to my knowledge, and certainly to my all of my years of experience, there's really nothing that can harm you that can survive in that concentration of salt. But Lactobacillus thrives in that condition, and it will just start going to work eating the, you know, the carbohydrates in the cabbage and lowering the pH. And then when it lowers the pH, aka making it more acidic, what it's doing is that it's sort of enacting a preservation kind of state for the cabbage. A lower pH is also inhibiting of further microbial growth. So you're kind of like introducing this inhibition through the salt, and then the bacteria takes the second step, makes it more acidic, and then it's really kind of a preserved food at that point, as well as a probiotic food.
And when do you do this in a jar that's been sterilized, or how do you prepare the jar?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely should work with always like clean hands, clean equipment. But the nice thing about fermenting, especially lacto-fermenting in this case, is that you don't have to be totally sterile. This isn't like canning where you have to be really careful about, you know, making sure that everything's been boiled or like put in a pressure cooker. You can just use soap and water and let things air dry. And that's good enough because, as we said, like there's already bacteria that you're introducing through the cabbage or through the food, the vegetable that you're putting into the jar. And the salt is the thing that's kind of providing the main, it's the bouncer, let's say, to the party.
And when your sauerkraut is ready, are there still live bacteria in there?
Yes, of course. I mean, as long as you haven't pasteurized it by like heating it up and killing it, which, you know, some commercial sauerkrauts will have had that happen. But yeah, no, there will be bacteria in there. I don't know what the populations look like from at the end of the process versus like, you know, in the middle when it's really active and bubbling. But yeah, there will be living bacteria.
And it gets active and bubbling.
Yes, absolutely.
That must be amazing watching that.
Fermentation is such a sensory thing. It engages you. You get to see so much visual change. You get to see so much. You get to smell so much sort of olfactory change. You get to taste so much gustatory change. You know, fermentation really is a sensory process that shows you transformation on many levels.
And I've heard that everybody says, oh, it's great to eat fermented foods, you know, sauerkraut and, you know, yogurt and other kinds of fermented products. But the fermented products that you buy in the supermarket, I gather, are they don't contain live populations of bacteria. They're somehow, I don't want to say inferior, but they're kind of a notch below the home ferments that haven't been pasteurized. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, like I don't have access to a microscope, so I can't necessarily verify whether or not there's like these living colonies of bacteria, but I think my understanding and the logic would go that something that's a raw ferment, something that hasn't been heat treated and pasteurized, is going to have some living bacterial culture remaining in it, and something that has been pasteurized will not. And, you know, if part of the goal in eating fermented foods is to introduce some live bacterial culture into our gut microbiome, that according to what I've read, you know, some live bacteria do make it through our stomach acid and into the gut, you know, to further colonize and strengthen the gut. So if that's part of your goal of eating the fermented food, then I think it is a good thing to try to eat the raw ferments rather than like something that has been fermented and then pasteurized. However, you know, if your goal in eating ferments is just the flavor, and maybe you do have some like health issues or something where you're concerned about consuming bacteria for any reason, maybe you have, you know, immunocompromised in some way and you've received medical advice to stay away from eating cultured foods, then it's also fine just to eat a pasteurized ferment, I would say personally.
Tell me about another one of your ferments that you really enjoy. Maybe, a juice or a drink.
Sure, yeah.
That's kind of fun and wild and amusing to create and tastes great and is healthy.
Right. Well, a type of drink that I've made and I've learned sort of by following the work of this California-based wild crafter, wild forager. His name is Pascal Baudard. He does this really neat thing. And I think this is also a Korean recipe as well, like a Korean sort of fermentation tradition. So I want to, you know, also cite that. But I did learn it from Pascal Baudard, which is to make a pine cone soda. So pine cones, green pine cones, not when they're like brown and all open and dry and crunchy, but you know, in that state when they're still kind of closed up and green, in the springtime usually, they are coated with, similar to the cabbage that has a coating of biofilm on it. These green pine cones are coated with a biofilm that contains, among many other things, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is it's the yeast that, ferments sugar into alcohol and makes a lot of our favorite drinks here on planet Earth. And so what you can do is you can take these green pine cones, you can submerge them into kind of like a sugar water solution. The sugar water will feed and activate the yeasts that are present on the green pine cones. You just kind of close them up into a jar. They start to bubble after a couple of days, usually super, super active, quite incredible. And you end up having this like really delicious fermented pine cone syrup that you can then use to sort of inoculate into other juices. If you want to make like a sparkling cider, sparkling juice, you can also just kind of like drink it on its own as a little aperitif. It's an incredible, incredible flavor.
So is there a philosophy for you behind fermentation?
Yes.
Do fermenters have a philosophy? Do they have an idea that animates them, that they're trying to advance and bring to fruition through fermentation? Or is it just fun and healthful?
I think it depends on who you're talking to, but I would say that like maybe among some of the more dedicated acolytes of this fermentation revival movement, and again, I have to sort of cite the work and influence of Sandor Katz in this. A lot of these sort of more vocal and more kind of, I almost want to say evangelizing, but maybe I should say like inoculating these kind of people who are carrying these ideas and spreading them forth about fermentation. There's a very strong kind of philosophical or like rhetorical political bent to it, which is that the fermentation itself is kind of a metaphor in their eyes for social change, for, you know, healthfulness, for kind of reintroducing ecological diversity, even at a micro scale, for kind of better relations between species. And so the fermentation as a practice becomes kind of like an index and a metaphor for these values. And of course, this is great, but these values are not necessarily inherent or essential to the act of fermentation, because fermentation is, as we're seeing, very much just capable of being industrialized and commodified, just like any other food process. So I think that, you know, it's important when we think about the sort of transformative potential of fermentation and of microbes to not get too caught up in thinking that this is sort of, that these principles go wherever they go. You know, we have to be conscious of the social contexts in which fermentation is practiced just as much as fermentation itself.
Is fermentation fun? Is it amusing?
I think it can be. Yeah.
Does it strike you as mysterious that you never quite know how things are going to turn out?
The mysteriousness shifts locations, maybe. Like, at first it seems very mysterious because you don't know what's going to happen at all. You're just sort of, it's an experiment. As you become more familiar with your ferments and with the bacteria that you work with, you know, you become a little bit more literate of the whole process and the signs and the sort of like markers of a good ferment or of a bad ferment. And so the mystery maybe kind of goes a little deeper. But yeah, there's definitely always mystery there.
Can one ferment meat products that are fermented?
Absolutely, yeah. Meats are one of the biggest, you know, categories of fermented foods.
Can you give me an example of a meat ferment that you do?
Yeah, I've made, foods that, you know, in the Italian tradition we would call salumis, sort of a fermented, dry cured meat sausages, or things like prosciutto, which are, you know, a whole leg of pork that's sort of like dried and fermented. So I've made some salamis and things like that. They take a lot of specialized equipment, and there's a higher risk of foodborne illness with those. So I tend to sort of do those maybe a little bit like less often. But yeah, fermented meat is super common worldwide. If you have ever had salami, that's a fermented meat.
Huh. And do you experiment? Do you just try this and that and you don't know exactly what's going to happen, but you figure you'll give it a shot, something you've never done before, and you think, I wonder what that would taste like if I mixed it with that and put some water in and salt, and I wonder what will happen.
Yeah, and definitely I will do that with things like vegetable ferments, absolutely, because I feel comfortable understanding the sort of safety principles of it. So I can, as long as you know that you're keeping a certain salt percentage by weight, you're keeping things submerged in an anaerobic environment, you can just have at her. It's really fun, you know, to see what flavors come out the other side of the fermentation. Sometimes it's surprising, you know, you put something in that has one taste and the microbes and the interaction with the other ingredients completely transform the taste profile.
Huh. Sounds magical to me.
That really is like the funnest part of fermentation, is sort of seeing what comes out the other side. Honestly, you know, it's quite romantic. There's quite a kind of romance to it in the 19th century sense of the term, you know, the idea of the sublime nature, the something that's kind of at once beautiful and awe-inspiring. And so that's kind of like where my eyes are focused, or my senses are focused, is kind of like looking at these current cultural manifestations of our understandings of microbes and our understandings of our place amongst different species, microbial species and other species, and even each other. And I think fermentation, because it is just such a kind of like big cultural thing right now, it's a great sort of space through which to look at these things.
And there is a fermentation revival going on, you're saying?
Huge revival. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's now past the state of being just a subcultural thing. It's, you know, the fermented foods industry is growing multi-billion dollar a year industry. And so there's just, you know, all of the sort of consequences of that, you know, when things become industrialized as well and marketed and capitalized. And yeah.
So how do you explain this culturally and historically, that there is a revival for fermentation, that people are getting, it's more in the popular culture and people are talking about it, there's greater interest about it. You know, all the while traditional cultures have practiced fermentation forever.
Right. Yes. I mean, exactly. An important point that I missed there, which is throughout most of the 20th century, well, since germ theory was basically established and proven through the work of early microscopy and, you know, and the research of people like Louis Pasteur, we, made some huge strides in understanding, you know, what was making people sick, the causes of disease and mortality. A lot of it was contamination and infection. So the technological and social advancements that we use to keep ourselves safer, you know, pasteurizing food, named after Pasteur, penicillin, you know, to protect, to stop infections in the body, antibiotics. So we've sort of, we moved into this world that was a very kind of antiseptic world, very, very pasteurized and evacuated of microbial life. And for a long time, for, you know, most of the 20th century, that was just sort of the way things were. You know, everything was sterile and increasingly industrialized, increasingly homogenized, increasingly packaged.
And this fear that microbes is thought of, idea about microbes as being dangerous.
Yes. And, it, you know, that's because in a, some of them really are. And that was, you know, these advancements were really good at like saving lives in the sense of helping us remove those really dangerous ones. But what that did was that really threw the baby out with the bathwater, because a lot of microbes, as we know, are essential to our thriving in existence. So fermentation revival is just part of, you know, figuring out how to reintroduce those into our diets, and also sort of more broadly and conceptually make more room for them in our, in a more kind of nuanced understanding of like the microbial landscape around us, and like which, you know, people talk about good and bad microbes, kind of trying to figure out what the good microbes are and how to foster them.
When Anna Sigrether isn't chopping up cabbage or pine cones, setting them up to ferment, she's studying fermentation culture at Concordia University in Montreal. Read more about kitchen countertop fermentation at greenplanetmonitor.net. Since the dawn of civilization, nothing has fascinated humans more than the diversity of life around them. Aristotle was among the first natural historians. Naturalis Historia by Pliny is the Roman Empire's largest surviving work. The collection, description, and preservation of living things has come a long way since then. Today, biologists use high-tech tools to collect creatures and DNA barcoding technology to identify them. Here's a story for you. I'm standing in a wooded park in the Dutch city of Leiden. Michael Steck, a researcher at the nearby Naturalis Biodiversity Center, is vacuuming the air with a handheld device called a pollen sniffer.
It's drawing in the air.
Steck studies simple plants called bryophytes, such as the mosses and liverworts. Today, he's prospecting for bryophyte spores. Anything else floating in the air will be sucked in too and get deposited on a sticky slide.
What you usually see are pollen grains and fungus spores. What I'm then interested is in fact how many spores, for example, of bryophytes are there at a certain moment.
The spores, plant hairs, and airborne microbes stuck to Michael Steck's pollen sniffer slide will get identified here at the Naturalis Center using DNA barcoding technology. Naturalis is home to one of the largest collections of animal, plant, and fungal specimens in the world, from all over the world. One of their big projects, Arise Biodiversity, aims to identify all forms of multicellular life in the Netherlands. 50,000 species is their target. They're up to 5,000. Dutch biologists and citizen scientists bring in specimens all the time.
Klaas brought us here three drawers of new specimens, the whole butterflies, Lepidoptera groups.
Hanko Bakker is in charge of receiving them.
And he brought us also a tray of bottles with caterpillars that we're going to try to get the DNA out of it. And I got two boxes here of genitalia preparates. These are sometimes necessary for identification of the species.
Klaas Kah specializes in butterflies and moths. And they're very tiny. These are
some are tiny, some are larger.
Klaus lives in the North Sea town of Den Helder, where Lepidoptera abound.
The other area where I often go is Den Helder. So I have about 800 species in total there over the last 30 years.